Here's John Wilson.
Hello. Kate Bush is one of the most innovative, idiosyncratic, and influential musicians of modern times. She disappeared from the public eye 12 years ago after the release of her last album. Finally, she's back with a new record. But what took her so long?
I think it's always an evolving process. And I've compared the process to kind of making wine, where you let it kind of ferment on the tape for a few years and it helps it mature and it comes out sounding better. And I think in this case we're talking about a distilling process rather than fermenting, so it's like making a whiskey, really. A kind of double whiskey, because it's, you know, a double album.
In a special edition of Front Row this evening, I'll be talking to Kate Bush about the process of distilling musical ideas into the recorded sounds that are released next week on the album Aerial. It's the most eagerly awaited new LP of the year and the most closely guarded. To hear it, I had to make several trips to the record company offices, where I was allowed to listen, on headphones, to a CD copy which appeared to be locked in a machine bolted to the floor. Securing an interview with the famously secretive Kate Bush proved equally difficult. How to Be Invisible is one of several new songs in which Kate Bush appears to reflect on her 12 years out of the spotlight. In tonight's interview, she talks about protecting her privacy, the state of modern pop, and the difficulty of balancing time between the nursery and the studio after the birth of her son, Bertie. In 1978, aged just 19, Kate Bush became an overnight star with her ethereal, musical interpretation of Emily Bronte's classic gothic romance. Wuthering Heights, Kate Bush's debut single, was a number one hit. The first album, The Kick Inside, was an astonishingly sophisticated collection of words and music, most of which had been written when she was just 15. Six albums followed, including the one regarded as her masterpiece, The Hounds of Love. But since 1993 and the release of The Red Shoes, virtually nothing has been heard from Kate Bush, until now. We met recently in the penthouse suite of Abbey Road Studios. I started by asking whether, having been away for so long, she'd actually stopped making music completely during this time.
I did actually stop completely for a while, which is very unusual. Normally I go straight from one project into another. And it was a very conscious decision to take a break. One of the first songs that I wrote was actually King of the Mountain. And so that would probably be 9 or 10 years ago. And even the vocal that I did is the same one. It was just like a throwaway vocal that I put down on the track. And then I probably didn't record anything again for maybe 2 or 3 years.
Really? That song itself that's around at the moment, that's 10 years old in effect.
Yes, it probably is getting on for 10 years, yeah.
Did it feel like you'd found something new, you'd started again, or was it just picking up where you left off?
Well, I think every time I make an album, I don't want it to be a continuation of what I've done before. It's very important for me that I feel that I'm doing something new. It's a shame that it's such a long process for me, because I worry that the ideas might sound dated or feel old-fashioned in some way.
Where does it start from? I mean, for instance, King of the Mountain, let's look at that as an example. Do you start with a lyric, an idea, an image in your head, or even a chord progression?
It was just a kind of chord progression that I had, and I just put this vocal down, which was extremely throwaway, which is why it's so surprising that I ended up keeping most of it as the master vocal.
So that's the demo vocal?
Yeah, it is, and I tried a few times to recreate it, and I couldn't get the same feeling.
Will you see me out of the weather? Will you hear the screaming out?
What's interesting about that vocal, the delivery of the words, is the way you almost mumble them. I mean, in the past, your diction has been so clear on that. And it sounds almost like you're masking the words. There's a sort of, you align words, and it's almost like you're making them up as you go along. But which many people, when they're talking about writing songs, they say they put the words in there and then come back to them later. You weren't doing that, but it's...
No, in fact, it was meant to be my impersonation of Elvis Presley.
Oh, that's the drawl, is it?
Yeah.
Why does a multi-millionaire fill up his home with priceless junk?
In fact, I heard this fantastic review on front row a few weeks ago with some guy who was saying he'd heard the single. He was saying, it's only in tune chords. And then they were discussing it more, and he was saying how it's about Elvis Presley. And it sounded really surprised that I should have written a song about Elvis Presley, which I love. I love the idea of doing something that isn't expected.
And there's a sense of isolation, of remoteness, and Elvis is the key image. There's also a reference to Citizen Kane, isn't there?
Yes.
Randolph Hearst. And about fame as well, I guess, and people wanting to get at you. Was there a sense of autobiography in that song as well?
Well, I was very much writing about Elvis, because I think he's one of those people who, I mean, that kind of fame that he must have been living with must have been unbearable. I can't imagine what it must be like. I don't think human beings are built to withstand that kind of fame.
But you had that. I mean, you had that incredibly quick, to the extent that he had, obviously, but you had overnight fame. You must have identified to an extent with Elvis's situation about people clawing at you and wanting a part of you.
Well, I suppose there's an element of that. I think the process is hard enough without taking on other people's baggage as well.
You've always been a very private person, though, haven't you? I mean, even after you started out, you did very few gigs, and you did start doing fewer and fewer interviews, and yet the songs have always been, on the first few albums at least, incredibly personal. Well, they seem like they were personal, seem like they were autobiographical, incredibly candid, and people get a sense of the sort of person you were. Have you stepped back, do you think, in this album? I mean, it's a very elemental album, isn't it? About sea, sky, wind, rain.
Well, yes, I am a private person, but I don't think I'm obsessively so. It's more that I choose to try and have as normal a life as possible. And I don't like to live in a glare of publicity. A long time ago, when I kind of finished making my second record, I realised that it was all the wrong way round. I was spending all my time doing interviews, television, press. Suddenly this was what my life had become. And my initial drive had never to be famous, it had been to make a record. So I turned it all around so that my time was being spent writing and then doing a little piece of promotion at the end. So, and to me that was the way that the balance worked best, because the creative process is something that I find very time consuming, and you have to have a lot of focus, and it comes from a quiet place. So this is what I'm trying to keep that balance of, which people seem to find very weird and strange, but to me it's completely, you know, it's common sense, surely.
What must make it even stranger is that the world has changed, the music world, music industry has changed completely since that last record. I bought the Red Shoes on vinyl, and when I bought that record there was no such thing as an MP3. The internet hadn't been invented. Now file sharing, music is downloaded, music is borrowed almost from the ether and then sent back into space. Does it feel like a very different world that you've re-entered?
Well, I've still been a part of the world. It's just I've not been...
I mean, the music world and the industry and that sort of...
Well, yeah, but I think the whole world has changed very much so, very quickly in the last 10 years, but particularly the last 5 years. I mean, I remember when I was a little girl, if you saw people walking around on the street laughing and talking to themselves, you thought they were mad. But now it just means they're on their mobile phone. And, you know, it, I think, would be a shame, amongst all this technology, for us to lose our sense of humanity. And music is suffering greatly from the overuse of computers and taking away the human element, which art is about human expression. And I think machines and technology should be used by people, not... You shouldn't be a slave to them.
Does it worry you the way that music's delivered now, increasingly, down a wire?
It's not the delivering down a wire. I think the sound quality is something that... It's a shame that that's deteriorating, really. But it was a very conscious decision for me with this record that I didn't write through a computer. A lot of my friends write on computers, so they every time you hit a chorus in the structure of a song, you just have a repeat of the same chorus. Now, for me, that's not art, because It should be something that's evolving and developing as you move through a song and changing, not just the repetition of the same moments, because I think what's so exciting about music is it is something that unfolds through the process of time. That's what music is. It's something that if people get it right, then you'll be whipped up into a trance frenzy or a state of prayer. Music is something very special and very emotive, and it's become very disposable.
Come up with a chord progression, as you say, looking at the mass, and you get an idea of Elvis in your head, and that's a sort of thematic idea. You work at home, of course, though, don't you? You have the studio, so
yes.
You're able just to get everything down as quickly as possible.
I think what's quite strange is that a lot of the writing process is really quick. I do that very quickly. But then the arrangement of the songs can be incredibly drawn out and long-winded and so frustrating.
Is that because you're a perfectionist in the studio?
I'm very opinionated. I'm horrible to work with. I'm so fussy and picky. And I think what's good is that I know what I want. And I think actually that's the most important thing.
You know what you want in your head?
Yes.
So you actually hear, you'd have heard the whole song, the finished song in your head then?
Well, I have a sense of the direction to go in, which is really important, because I think it's when you don't know what you want that you're in trouble.
When you get to the studio, and I mean, you don't have to get to the studio, you're working at home, in effect. That must help the process, I presume, doesn't it?
It's very important for me, because now I have a child. I wouldn't have been able to work at all if I hadn't have been able to work at home. It's also... it helps me to get a very good creative focus, because one of the things that's very difficult is the distractions that come into what should be a very quiet, focused process. What was difficult was trying to fit the album in around bringing up a child, because I didn't want anything to interfere with that process. You know, I wanted to give as much time as I possibly could to my son. I love being with him. He's a lovely little boy, and he won't be little for very long. I felt that my work could wait, really, whereas his growing up process couldn't.
To me, the album has a more sparse and spacious quality to the last work. I mean, Red Shoes 13 years ago, but before that, The Sensual World. Both very, very rich sound, layer upon layer. Was there a conscious attempt to make something that was possibly simpler musically?
Very much so. I've always tried to be adventurous, and I think one of my faults is that I have a tendency to overdo things. And what was good about taking a gap after the last record was I had a chance to actually sit back and think about what were the things that I felt that I kept getting wrong that I wanted to try and sort out. Because one of the common problems with human beings generally is you tend to keep making the same mistakes again and again. I wanted to make a record that had much more space in it. And I also wanted to stand in the role of narrator much more, rather than it being the person inside the song. I wanted to stand outside and talk about situations outside of myself. Part of that process was also to not have very many backing vocals, to have a greater sense of one voice telling a story.
Did you have the idea of the themes? And you say there's two records, two distinct records, both driven by a narrator. But did you have the idea of the sea and the sky? Was that always going to be the dual theme?
No, in fact it was more a sense of single songs that would be, each one would be about a person. And then this idea of some kind of conceptual piece was something that just gradually started to evolve.
Individual characters that emerge over the course of the album. You have the narrator, I mean, this Mrs. Bartolozzi, and this is a woman, I presume this is the name of the woman who you are describing, cleaning the house almost obsessively, piling the clothes into the washing machine, watching them tumble around. There's a beautiful idea of the woman's shirt and the man's trousers intertwining. That was about somebody else then, was it, rather than you at home, living the domestic life?
Well, I do a lot of washing. I'm sure I would never have written the song if I didn't. You know, just this woman in her house with her washing, and then the idea of taking the water in the washing machine with all the clothes and the water then becoming the sea. And I also think there's something very interesting about clothes. They're kind of people without the people in them, if you know what I mean. They all have our scent and pieces of us on them somehow. Washing machine.
And several of the songs during the lyrics, one idea sparks off another, and so when the woman's looking at the washing machine and the clothes spinning round, suddenly she's thinking about the sea. It happens elsewhere in A Coral Room, when the idea is you're on a boat looking down into the water underneath, and there's almost a lost city under there with all the fishermen's nets like spiders' webs, and beautiful imagery. But then suddenly, with the hand trailing in the water, it's the idea of an old jug in your mind, which belonged to your mother. That she, your mother did have that jug, didn't she? Am I reading too much?
No, it's fantastic. There were hundreds of people in a little brown jug, actually, yeah. The song is really about the passing of time. I like the idea of coming from this big, expansive, outside world of sea and cities into, again, this very small space where it's talking about a memory of my mother and this little brown jug. I always remember hearing years ago this thing about a sort of Zen approach a knife, where you would hold something in your hand knowing that at some point it would break, it would no longer be there.
So many times in the past in songs sung almost as a child. You've sung about your parents, your father's appeared on your records. The last record was dedicated to your mother. I mean, and people have talked about the childlike quality of your voice. Is this a record that is made by a mother rather than a child?
Yes, I think it probably is.
I mean, has the process of motherhood bringing up a son, that has changed the way that you compose and write and perform, do you think?
Yes, I think it has. And I think also, as well as being a mother, when you lose your mother, you're no longer a little girl anymore. And so I've had a lot of things that have changed me over the years from the last album to this.
Yeah, I think on the last record there's a great, I mean, some of the songs heartbreakingly sad on Red Shoes, and The Sensual World was a real exploration, celebration of love and sex, but very dark very often, those songs, almost like a claustrophobic feeling. And on this record, on Aerial, as the title suggests, there is a sense of freedom, I think, and space. You feel like you're in a wider open space making this record, because there wasn't the pressure, because you weren't in the public eye, because you had in effect disappeared for a while.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways I got my life back, and it's very important to me as a creative person, as a writer, which is what I think of myself as. We went up to the top of the highest hill and stopped still. I'm somebody who writes, and then I sing and produce in order to make the piece complete.
But writer in the literary way.
Yes, yeah. That's what I started doing when I was a little girl. That's what turned me on. That's the buzz. It's writing a story.
And there have always been literary allusions in your work, right from Wuthering Heights with Bronte. The song The Sensual World, you're actually, that's about Molly Bloom. It's her soliloquy at the end of Ulysses of James Joyce, isn't it? I know you couldn't actually use Joyce's words, but you had to invent your own version of her story. And of course Aerial itself, it's the name of Sylvia Plath's most famous collection. Is that a nod to her at all, or is that just a coincidence?
I think it's just a coincidence, which there seem to be a lot of, big people mention lots of things, like apparently there's a Mrs. Bartolozzi who Joseph Haydn wrote pieces for, who I was completely unaware of.
Where did her name come from, then, in your mind?
Just thought it was a really interesting name. It is, though, isn't it? It's a great name.
It's a great name.
I tried a few others, but they didn't work as well. You know, Mrs. Brown doesn't quite do it, does it?
It struck me how live this album sounded as well. I mean, live drums all the way through, all frequently used throughout the record. And in a way, I suppose 20 years ago with The Hounds of Love, you were really at the cutting edge of technology, using those Fairlight computers and being able to sample sounds and manipulate sounds for the first time, and you were seen almost as a real pioneer. So in a way, you've stepped back then, and you're relying more on acoustic instruments, or those that respond to the human touch more.
Well, I've always liked the combination of both.
And the juxtaposition.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. The fact that you've got these very cold machines against something very warm.
Are there echoes of The Hounds of Love on this album, do you think? I mean, people will see the second disc, A Sky of Honey, which is almost a song cycle and takes you through a passage of time as the sun is going down and we go through night. It's a song called Nocturne. And then we arrive back at the end of the album as the sun is rising again. There's a real passage there, similar in a way to that second side of Hounds of Love, which took you on a journey.
I really enjoyed making Hounds of Love. I liked the two different elements. And I think in a lot of ways I was trying to make just a larger version, a kind of Great Danes of Love.
You have returned. I mean, you might not feel like you ever stopped making music and your life has continued. But was it a dilemma, though, to do any promotion at all? Because, of course, the whole promotions industry, the whole music industry is predicated these days on a sense of celebrity.
Well, I think there's a really unhealthy fascination with celebrities. And in a lot of cases, you know, people who, you know, what they're doing is fine, but it's not really something that is so enormously special. I mean, you know, this sort of strange obsession with things that are really rather shallow.
Do you feel like a celebrity yourself?
No, I don't. No.
Are you aware of the influence of your music on subsequent generations? And also the fact that there are so many solo young women singer-songwriters, far more than when you first appeared.
Yes.
Many of whom would cite you as an influence.
I feel very flattered. How nice.
What about your own influences these days? I think there's an interesting mirroring of when you first arrived, 1978, punk rock was, well, I suppose, filtering out, but guitars were to the fore. And here you were, a young girl, pirouetting on top of the pop, singing about a literary heroine in a leotard. Your return.
So was the heroine in the leotard or me?
Actually,
I wasn't wearing a leotard.
You're not. Some people always think of you as a leotard. Was that
yes.
The video?
Well, it was, if I remember correctly, it was a long white dress.
Oh, it was, wasn't it? And then, of course, you became the White Witch.
Yes, well, here we go. Here we go.
But now you've come back, and so much of the music, the guitar music, the young bands, they're harking back to the late 70s. It was quite interesting that you started off with that going on, and now here you are. Do you listen to what's happening? Do you take any notice of contemporary music?
When I'm making a record, I try not to listen to music because I don't want to be influenced. There was a very strong presence of traditional music when I was growing up, and I think that had a very big influence on me.
Folk music?
Yes.
English folk music in particular?
Yes.
Because there's always been a real English element, I think, to your music, a real pastoral, almost like a celebration of a lost England. That's something that occurs, isn't there?
One thing I've always tried to do is to sing with an English accent, because again, when, maybe not so much now, but when I first was making records, it always used to surprise me how so many English people were singing with American accents, and I could never really understand why people were doing this.
But the stuff that you were listening to as a girl, how did that filter into those first... I mean, for instance, it said that you wrote Man with a Child in His Eyes at 13. You did it come easily? I mean, it seems yes. Incredible to me now that a girl of 13 could write that song.
Well, the hardest bit for me was the piano part. I used to have to rehearse like crazy to get those because I'm not really a very good piano player. He's very understanding, and he's so aware of all my situations.
Do you ever go back and listen to the early records?
No.
None of them. When was the last time you heard A Kick Inside?
I can't remember.
I mean, would you be able to play them again?
No, I mean, I tend to sort of dump them onto tape and leave them. Quite often I can't even remember what key the songs are in.
So you've been working on this record on Ariel for 6 years, and you said earlier it was almost like a process of distillation, and you have to let it sit there in the vat and ferment and change, and finally you hand it over to the public. Is that is there a sense of relief when you do that? Or reluctance?
Oh, I was so relieved when I finished this record. I thought I was never going to get it finished. There were so many times I thought that I was just not going to have the energy to just see it through. It was really hard work. I always tend to try and do things that are a bit over-ambitious, really.
How did you know when it was finished? Somebody had to come in the room and say, stop now.
No, it was when I knew that, you know, I couldn't go on any longer. It would have killed me. I was so fed up with it. So fed up with listening to the thing.
I know you would argue that you haven't been away, you've just been getting on with your life, but people will say Kate Bush has returned. Is it good to be back?
Well, it's very nice speaking to you, Jim.
Kate Bush, thank you very much.
Thank you.